From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. In a few years, oil rigs could go up along the Georgia coast.
It is a huge coast. We only have 100 miles of it here in the state of Georgia. There's a possibility there's some oil or natural gas deposits off of here, or, you know, they might hit the mother lode up in the Carolinas. We just don't know.
Last week, the Trump administration released a new plan for offshore drilling. We'll talk about the implications for our state. First, though, we recently talked about the wage gap between men and women. A study finds the gap is larger in the South than anywhere else in the nation, and closing that would cut poverty for working women here by more than half. We asked Chandra Childers about this. She's a postdoctoral fellow at the Institute for Women's Policy Research.
The occupations that men and women hold, you know, you talk about leading down to the cause, that is actually a big part of the gender wage gap. It's not all, it does not explain all of the gender wage gap, but it is a big part of the differences in earnings between men and women.
Here are your first thoughts. Heidi in Macon says, in her experience, roles in the workplace are not equal between men and women.
I found that regardless of my education and my background and experience, in every job I've had, I've always defaulted to that of secretary or administrative assistant. People just think it's okay to give me their money and ask me to order lunch or to fill up their coffee for them. So, no, women are not equal in the workplace. Thank you.
Thanks to Heidi, and we would love to get your thoughts as well. You can call us, like she did, at 404-500-9457. You can also tweet us. It's at OST Talk. Remember, we might feature your comments on the show. This hour, we'll get into some really serious questions about science, economic development, and where those two intersect. We'll also talk about launching into space, going to the ocean's depths for oil. But first, let's revisit a conversation I recently had about the power of curiosity for its own sake. The Ig Nobel Prizes reward silliness in science. They've been awarded annually since 1991, and they honor achievements that first make you laugh and then make you think. In October, I spoke to Georgia Tech doctoral student Patricia Young. She was part of an Ig Nobel Prize-winning team in 2015. And I spoke to Mark Abrams, founder of the Ig Nobel Prizes. So, Mark, the first, when you were batting this around with whomever you were discussing it, what was the concept behind creating it?
Back in 1990, I became the editor of a science magazine. And suddenly, I was meeting people.
One that I read, which is called?
One which you don't, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, I read Improbable Research.
Oh, well, you're wonderful.
Oh.
It was the predecessor,
oh.
Which was a much older magazine called the Journal of Irreproducible Results, which got put to death by its publisher a few years later.
Okay.
And on. Anyway, I discovered that when you become the editor of a science magazine, suddenly you meet all kinds of people who've done things you hadn't dreamed of. And a lot of them had done things that were very funny and thought-provoking, and I kept thinking, this person eventually is going to die, and nobody in the world will ever know this person did this, and that's terrible. Somebody should do something. It should be commemorated. And then I realized, well, we can do something small, and from that little seed, this great oak grew.
Patricia, did you know about these prizes before you actually won one?
Yes, I'm still a big fan of that prize.
Why?
It just... The winner there, they did so creative and novel things you have ever thought of, and it just make you laugh.
So what did you win for?
I study how long does it take for your animal to urinate.
Right. Okay, so you discovered a universal urination time.
Yes.
And how did you basically found out that all animals pee for about 21 seconds at a time?
Yeah, we say about because it's 21 plus minus 13, so usually from 10 to 30 seconds.
Okay, and how did you first start on even looking into that?
I like animals a lot, so I said to my advisor, I can do anything for you as long as you let me go to Atlanta.
As long as you go to Atlanta.
Yeah.
And you ended up not only watching animals pee, but then watching YouTube videos.
Yeah, so we bring all our fancy equipment to Zoo Atlanta to film elephant peeing, goat peeing, every animal, not everyone, and then a lot of YouTube videos online.
Right. And the phrase is pee like a racehorse, right? But racehorses don't pee any longer than anyone else.
No, it's still 21 seconds.
Okay. So the best one was, I think the longest one you found was a YouTube video of a dog that had eaten a watermelon.
Yeah, it's over a minute.
Took over a minute to pee.
Yeah.
Okay. Mark, what makes that project a perfect Ig Nobel project?
To win one of these prizes, there's only one quality. It's that whatever the thing is, it makes people laugh. And then it sticks in their head, and they keep thinking about it.
Right, because why do all these animals, even an elephant, pee for the same length?
Yeah. We give 10 prizes a year, and they're on any subject. A lot of them are science prizes, but we give a peace prize often, a literature prize. And for whatever it is, no matter what part of the world, it's that thing that whoever hears about it, it makes them laugh, and then they want to tell their friends about it.
If you're just joining us, and we're talking about the Ig Nobel Prizes, founded in part by Mike Abrams, along with help, and also we're hearing from Georgia Tech doctoral student Patricia Young. She was awarded an Ig Nobel Prize for her work in universal urination in 2015. There's this other kind of cool thing that you do that I wish the Oscars would start doing. You have a method for keeping people's acceptance speeches short. So let's hear, this is Charles Clements, who won for biology, and he's going a little too long. And what you have is a small girl on stage. I assume she needs to be adorable.
She's an adorable 8-year-old girl.
Right. Named Sweetie Pie.
Miss Sweetie Pooh.
Sweetie Pooh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And she waits. She's basically just standing there waiting for people to talk too long.
I specifically want to salute Hugh Cott, who pioneered the general science of tasting wildlife from strange places during World War II.
Please stop. I'm bored.
And she keeps chanting, please stop.
She just stands there saying, please stop. I'm bored. Please stop. I'm bored, until the person stops. We have never found an adult who could withstand the power of an 8-year-old child.
And it actually is pretty effective, because she only has to say it a few times, as far as I've seen, before.
Oh, yeah.
They,
well,
the
first
stage.
Year we did this, that's almost 20 years ago, the first year we had an 8-year-old girl on staff, on stage, the entire ceremony was an hour shorter than the year before. And ever since, we have finished on time.
That's great. Now, let's hear from Andre Geim, who won an Ig Nobel in 2000. And he won it tell me what he won his prize for?
He's a physics professor from Europe. He used magnets to levitate a frog,
which nobody thought was possible. So here's a little bit of his acceptance speech. And he's talking about the fact that he ended up getting letters from people all over the world.
The most funny one came from the leader of a small sect in Britain, who offered us £1 million if we could levitate him in front of his congregation.
Yeah, that's somebody, a religious leader, that wanted them to levitate him.
All kinds of things. That was in the year 2000 that we gave Andre Geim that Ig Nobel Prize. 10 years later, he was given a Nobel Prize.
A real Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how often do the people who win Ig Nobel Prizes actually go on to more significant work?
Well,
I don't want to say more significant. That sounds dismissive. Or things that are recognized by a more prestigious.
Well, of course, every human being in the world goes on to do better and better
right.
things. So that's the real answer. But quite a few of the people who have gotten Ig Nobel Prizes have gone on to great acclaim in their own fields in whatever they do. Sometimes it's for what won them the prize, but often it's just they're interesting people. They keep doing these astounding, brilliant things.
Patricia, do you find that people actually recognize you as an Ig Nobel?
Oh, yes.
They do.
After that, yeah. People talk to me on campus.
Random people walk up and say, hey, didn't you win
an Ig? Is that you? Is that the winner? And I say, yeah, I am. With very slightly smile.
Now, there's no prize money for an Ig Nobel.
That was true for a long time because we have no money, so we couldn't. But a few years ago, we figured out how we can give a cash award to each new winner. And now each new Ig Nobel Prize winner is awarded $10 trillion. It's a $10 trillion bill from Zimbabwe. You can buy it on eBay for about $4. The government official in Zimbabwe, who is responsible for coming up with those $10 trillion bills, by the way, also won an Ig Nobel Prize in mathematics.
So, Patricia, you have a $10 trillion...
No, my advisor still holds it.
Oh, I see.
But we signed a check.
Okay, and but you pay attention to other Ig Nobel winners.
Yeah, yeah, we are a big family now, and we recognize each other.
And have you continued to work in universal urination?
No, I'm working on universal defecation.
We're going to not talk about that.
No problem.
It was thoughtful of you to ask. You know, there's another Ig Nobel Prize winner in Atlanta, Franz De Waal at Emory University.
The great animal intelligence expert.
Yeah, who he and one of his students won a prize because they did an experiment and they showed that chimpanzees are able to recognize specific other chimpanzees by looking at photographs of their rear ends.
I'm going to steer away from that also.
Well, I'll mention only that when he talks about this in public, which he does quite often,
yes.
Inevitably somebody in the audience will ask him, have you tested this with human beings?
That was the question I was trying not to ask. Is there an answer?
Looking at you across the room, I knew that you wanted to be able to ask the question, but to be able to not actually ask it.
And his answer? Because we have to have the answer now.
Usually he'll smile.
And he doesn't really say.
And then he'll say, not yet.
Although human beings often can recognize odors, so.
Yeah, you know,
maybe.
If you have any insight on this, I'm sure I at least would love to hear it.
Yeah, call Mark Abrams.
But I expect that many people listening today would love to hear your thoughts on this.
Okay, so what do you think is there a larger purpose for the Ig Nobel?
In a way, we hope that when people look over the list of winners that you can see on improbable.com, they're all listed there, that some of these things will appeal to you enough that you start to think, hey, I can pay attention to things around me every day. That, you know, everybody's telling me that woman over there is doing something stupid. But when I look at what she's doing, is it really stupid? And maybe it's pretty damn good. And other people are telling me, look at that guy there. He's doing something that's wonderful. But I can look at that thing myself, and maybe I'll decide differently. So we hope that people will get a little more into the habit of looking at strange things and making their own decision about whether they think it's good or bad.
Patricia, in the minute that we have left, do you think something like this ruins the dignity of science? Do you think we should be taking science more seriously?
No, we should take science more in a way that with humor.
Why?
I think that's the only way to motivate more people into science.
Mark, would you agree with that?
Everything that we're taught in school as an important piece of science, when it was brand new, in its very earliest days, almost everybody made fun of it.
That was Ig Nobel Prize founder Mark Abrams, and Patricia Young, her work at Georgia Tech, won a prize in 2015. Just ahead, what are your favorite songs by any Georgia artist? We'll get picks from the Athens band Dream Culture. First, though, could space travel boost coastal Georgia's economy? This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought. SpaceX continues to make headlines, sending its Falcon rockets into space, sometimes successfully, sometimes not. And if Georgia has its way, those rockets might soon blast off from Camden County. A public report on Camden County's bid for a spaceport came out recently, and Laura Forsyk is an author of that report and the owner of Astralytica. The Atlanta-based consulting firm is working on Camden County's plans for a launch site. Hi there.
Hello.
So this for us is kind of an update on this bid. This is a very long process to get a spaceport going. Where are we in this process?
That's correct. And it's long for a reason, because it's a very important project that needs to go through a lot of regulations and a lot of approvals. And so where we are is in that last step where the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, is doing checks, their last minute checks to make sure that this is going to be approved. And sometime this year, we will have final public briefings to make sure that the public is on board, along with the government, to make sure we can put this together successfully.
Does the public, I mean, they often have public meetings, but does the public actually, let's say the public came out and said, no, we don't want this, do they actually get a say?
Oh, yes. So, of course, the public has a say in what happens in their own community. However, what we've seen so far in this process is that the public is very widely on board with this, especially the local community.
I wanted to make, again, we're talking about a minority of people, but our producer did speak to Steve Winkle. He's a retired engineer. He's a resident of Woodbine, Georgia, and he is very opposed to the project.
Well, there's no room for compromise for the spaceport that Camden County has proposed. I've evaluated and I've just come to the conclusion that if I were even a businessman, I wouldn't be considering it. If I were an environmentalist, absolutely not. And as a resident of Camden County, I don't want my taxes to go to waste over it.
Now, here he doesn't make specific complaints. He has a website where he makes specific complaints. What do you make of the comments that this is dangerous environmentally?
If it was dangerous environmentally, it would not be approved by the FAA. The FAA's job, along with other government agencies, is to make sure that this is safe for the community and safe for the surrounding areas. So that includes a bit of Florida as well as Georgia. And if this were unsafe in any way, this would not be approved. So the whole process, the long process that you mentioned, is so that we can make sure that this is something that is positive to move forward with.
Now, a spaceport isn't just about rocket launches. Those are the things that gets televised. But what are the things that happen at a spaceport day to day?
Absolutely. So I think that the spaceport launches are what gets the most attention because that's what people see. And that is very
cool
exciting.
To watch. Yeah.
Yes. But the whole point of a rocket launch is to get something into space. And so the variety of payloads that go into space, the reason why you're listening to this broadcast right now is because we have antenna that can listen to satellites that are surrounding Earth right now that are broadcasting to everyone who can listen. And so we have broadcast and data and the things that we rely on day-to-day basis that we don't think about, as well as scientific experiments and Earth observation and such a wide variety of applications that some of them haven't even been thought of yet. So it's the point of the whole spaceport is to get things to space. And we're not even talking about people necessarily. We're talking about things that make our lives on Earth better.
Like the satellites you're talking about.
Like the satellites, like our cell phones, like everything that we use in the modern day life.
So you're obviously a supporter of this effort to get the spaceport in Camden County. That's fair?
So I am an independent consultant, and I am a fan of space in general. And as long as the FAA and the government approves this project, I think it's fantastic to go forward with. I have looked in depth at the benefits to Georgia and the surrounding Camden community, and I think that it'll help not just the state of Georgia, but as well as the immediate people surrounding the spaceport. So the residents of Camden County and the residents of the surrounding Southeast Georgia area will all have some great benefits to the spaceport.
Is there enough space business to justify a new spaceport?
There will be. So what you've seen so far before this spaceport is even formally approved is a lot of interest from launch service providers. In fact, there was one called Vector that launched a test rocket last year. It was a low altitude launch, 10,000 feet. So it didn't go to space. But there's already been activity at the spaceport without it even being finally approved, which tells you how much interest there is once it is actually approved. What's going to happen down there?
So you went kind of quickly over what the next steps are. One of them is a public comment period. What's our timeline for the spaceport? Should everything go through
if everything goes through, it really just depends on the interest. So you mentioned that there's a lot of interest already. So one of the things that'll happen is that companies will start coming in, as well as the Camden County government, which has already been involved in this process from the start, and working together along with other universities and educational institutions and nonprofits and anybody else who wants to be involved will come together and make not just the spaceport happen, but also a research park adjacent to the spaceport, which can bring in new companies, companies that already exist, educational institutions that might want to expand to the area or even start up, just all kinds of things, museums and other educational opportunities. So it's really going to be a community effort to bring everybody together.
Do we have a price tag for
this? No, there is no price tag at this moment because it's quite open-ended. It can be as small or as large as the community wants it to be. And when I'm talking community, I'm talking the larger technology community, not just Camden County.
Just Camden County.
Yeah,
but
so it could be small. It could be the next Florida. You know, it really just depends on what it is that we make of it.
So what would be the earliest that we would see the spaceport open? Any idea?
This year.
This year?
So we've already seen last year a company called Vector, which just brought their rocket off of a truck and launched it. And so if you've got that minimal infrastructure need, then you can just start launching things pretty much immediately as soon as they're approved. You don't need a whole lot of infrastructure in place for some of these newer technologies.
That's pretty amazing. Laura Forsick is with the firm Astralytica. The company was hired to research and the spaceport in Camden County. You can get more information at our website, gpbnews.org. And of course, if you live in Camden County, the surrounding areas, we welcome your comments on this proposed spaceport as well. Laura, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Last week, the Trump administration released a new plan for offshore drilling. The U.S. Department of the Interior may conduct auctions to open new oil and gas wells along both the Atlantic and Pacific continental shelves. It may also sell new oil leases near Alaska and in the Gulf of Mexico. That means within a few years, there could be oil rigs within 100 miles of the Georgia coast. In 2015, I talked about oil and gas exploration with Alice Kies. She's associate director of 100 Miles, a coastal advocacy organization. And I spoke to Hunter Hopkins, the executive director of the Georgia Petroleum Council. So, Hunter, let me start with you. Do we know if there's oil out there?
The last surveys that were done off the Georgia coast are over 30 years old. And at that point, they do believe that there are some deposits out there, but due to the technological advances that we've had in the oil and natural gas industry over the past few years, we think there might be more than what we think. And with this decision coming down from the Obama administration, all we're looking to do is just go out and do some surveying to see if there are any oil or natural gas deposits.
So I'm assuming that you're in favor of this plan, at least the exploration part.
Yeah, yes, ma'am.
And Alice, you, I am assuming, are against it.
Yes. Actually, we're very concerned about the five-year plan that was released on Tuesday. But as you mentioned, the first part of any type of drilling activity is the exploration. And the exploration permits have already begun. 10 preliminary permits to explore offshore energy and oil reserves have already been issued. Five of those are off the coast of Georgia. The exploration process involves seismic air guns that basically release blasts of air into the ocean. They bounce off of the ocean floor back to some sensors on the surface of the water to determine where and potentially and to estimate how much oil and gas reserves are there. That's of particular concern, especially for the marine mammals in our oceans, and of particular concern to us in Georgia is the safety and well-being of the North Atlantic right whale, Georgia's state marine mammal. There are only 400 of those individuals that exist today, and they come to the coast of Georgia, the northern part of Florida, to have their babies. And so our ocean is already littered with noises, and adding major blasts from seismic guns could be devastating to this really already threatened population.
Hunter, let me give you a chance to respond to that. How can you explore without damaging the marine life in the ocean?
Well, Celeste, the seismic surveying is what it's called, the process has somewhat been described already. But we've got research, and the Bureau of Ocean and Energy Management has said that they feel that seismic surveying does not affect ocean aquatic life, especially right whales, dolphins, sea turtles. There are some disruptions that occur because these boats are trolling along the coast, and they're shooting these the sonic booms kind of down into the ground, trying to see what is under the bed of the seafloor. And there have been known to be disruptions in the aquatic life, but upon further study, it shows that most of the animals all return to that spot. You know, another thing to raise is, you know, we here above ground, I mean, above the water, you know, humans, bats, dogs, we all hear at different frequencies. Well, some of your aquatic life, they have different frequencies in which they hear as well, hear different noises. And most of your seismic surveying is not as much of a blast as it is just a low tone. And a lot of folks and some research is out there that shows that, you know, a lot of those animals aren't very sensitive to those low tones.
Well, let me take that back to you then, Alice. Obviously, seismic exploration has been seen as an alternative to some of the more invasive exploration, the more perhaps damaging ways they have of detecting oil. What do you feel about the research showing it doesn't permanently do damage to either the marine life or the plant life?
Well, the marine mammals are the species in particular that we're concerned about because they use underwater communication to stay in touch with each other. And especially with the right whales coming to the Georgia coast and traveling along the eastern seaboard for their migration route, they have to stay really close together because of our muddy waters. And so if we disrupt that communication, we could potentially separate mother from baby, and that could be, again, devastating to an already threatened group of the species.
Hunter, do the companies choose their timing for exploration or their timing for the seismic, what did you call it, seismic exploration?
Seismic surveying.
Would it pause to let the right whales come through and give birth, or how do they choose that?
Most of your seismic surveying vessels actually do have some type of biologist or scientist on board that does that. Their responsibility is to view the aquatic life in the area.
So if they saw a right whale there, they wouldn't do
Yeah,
it.
They could shut off operations for a little while and kind of let it pass and then pick it up at a later time, or they could just kind of scrub it for the day and come back at a different time.
They could, but there's nothing that makes them. There's no regulation. Alice, let me play for you another comment from Tybee Island Mayor Jason Belterman. Take a listen.
I would feel much less comfortable if I was the mayor of a town on the Gulf Coast where they have deep water drilling, or they did prior to Deepwater Horizon. So being on the East Coast is a much different situation in terms of the ability of companies to do it in a way that's more environmentally conscious and sensitive, just because it's more shallow water.
Thank you for that, Celeste. It's really important to think about the implications of this five-year plan. We talked a little bit, about the seismic activities. The seismic testing is the first step to the actual drilling.
Right. And he's talking there about the point when they would actually get to drilling.
So one of the things that we as Georgians have to think about is the transformation of our coastal communities that could happen if offshore drilling for oil and gas is allowed. Our communities have worked very hard, Tybee included, to build a $2 billion tourism industry. And our real estate market that seems to be recovering, is a lot of it is based around scenic vistas and access to natural areas and our pristine beaches. If oil and gas reserves are discovered off the Georgia coast, we feel that the amounts that are estimated to be produced are not worth the cost of the impact to the tourism industry and our wildlife. I grew up in Louisiana. I vacationed on the Gulf Coast my entire life. And those communities are really built around these refineries. And, you come off of the white sand beaches to the five-story condominium built on top of the dunes, and you look out and you see the refineries, and you look out into the water and you do see the oil rigs.
Yeah.
And we just have to wonder if that's what we really want for our Georgia coast.
Well, let me let Hunter respond to that. And obviously a lot of people are very cautious, especially considering the spill that took place not too far south of us, Hunter. So is it worth the potential cost?
I think it's worth it to at least go out and see what we have off the coast. We're just asking for the opportunity to go out there and see what is out there. And you know what? It's a huge coast. We only have the Atlantic coast is, I'm not sure exactly how long, but we only have 100 miles of it here in the state of Georgia. There's a possibility there's some oil or natural gas deposits off of here, or, they might hit the mother lode up in the Carolinas. We just don't know. We are just asking and applauding the federal government for the opportunity to go out there and see.
That was Hunter Hopkins, Executive Director of the Georgia Petroleum Council. And you heard Alice Kies. She's Associate Director of the Coastal Environmental Advocacy Organization, 100 Miles. If it's adopted, the federal plan unveiled this week would replace an Obama-era ban on drilling in the Atlantic Continental Shelf. Just ahead, Martin Luther King Day is coming up, and a new novel explores how his teachings have endured the tests of time. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Last summer's chaos in Charlottesville raised a number of questions about Southern identity. An important one is, how do we look at and contextualize Confederate symbols? In Georgia, we have many monuments that honor Confederate soldiers. Decatur, Athens, Rome, and dozens more cities are home to statues and memorials and markers. There have been a number of calls to move or demolish those markers. Here's President Trump's feelings on those efforts.
Was George Washington a slave owner? So will George Washington now lose his status? Are we going to take down, are we going to take down statues to George Washington? How about Thomas Jefferson? What do you think of Thomas Jefferson? You like him? Okay, good. Are we going to take down the statue? Because he was a major slave owner. Now, are we going to take down his statue?
We also talked about this with Valerie Babb, director of the Institute for African American Studies at UGA. She says it might be worth it to keep them up so we can understand them better.
What I think we're talking about is rethinking what those memorials represent, because they're not really about the past. They're more about our attitudes towards race and justice today. So I think people who are calling for taking them down probably are really calling for a reevaluation of where we stand towards our history and towards what those monuments represent.
And we've been asking you about this. We visited the Confederate statue in downtown Macon. Here's what Maconite Calvin Watkins had to say about that memorial.
Since I've been in Macon all my life, and it been sitting there, and I'm 74 years old, well, for my part, really, I think it need to come down.
We also spoke to another Macon resident, Lori Scott. She has a different opinion.
You can't change history, so what's the point of taking down the monuments? That's what history is. You see what happened in the past, so you don't prevent it from happening in the future.
And now it's your turn. We are collecting your opinions, your perspectives on Confederate monuments in Georgia. Later this month, we'll dedicate a full hour to discussing what those memorials mean to our state and what we should do about them. We need your input, so call us at 404-500-9457. Leave us a message telling us about a Confederate monument that's near you and what you think should be done about it. You can also post to our Facebook page, of course, or tweet us. We're at OST Talk. And you can also email us. There's any number of ways to reach us. Our email address is onsecondthought@gpb.org. Dear Martin is Atlanta author Nick Stone's latest novel. In it, she explores police violence against people of color through the eyes of a teenage boy. She tries to understand racism by asking if Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s teachings still hold up. We spoke with author Nick Stone in October.
Hi, Celeste. It's nice to be here.
You want, this is going to be a spoiler-free interview, but I think we can start at the very beginning, at the very opening. The lead character of your novel is handcuffed and nearly arrested for trying to help out one of his friends who's drunk. And it just shapes the whole rest of the book. That's when he begins writing these letters to Dr. Martin Luther King. Why start there?
I once heard somebody say that you should always open a story with a bang of action, like, and then the shot went off. You know, you want to open your story in a way that's going to grip your reader. And really, I started there because that's the catalyst for this drastic change in his worldview. He's trying to help this girl get home, and he is, you know, he's dressed in, he's got a hoodie on, and there are things about his appearance that make this police officer.
He's got a hoodie from his prep school,
from his prep school, exactly.
And he's wearing headphones.
Yeah. And there are things about him, though, that make this officer suspicious, and I think would make a lot of people suspicious. But that's why I started the novel that way, because I want people to see that, like, just because a person looks a certain way doesn't necessarily mean that they're up to no good.
You know, we'll talk a little bit about some of the themes that are in there, but you must have heard the news that one school has taken To Kill a Mockingbird out of its curriculum because it makes students uncomfortable. And the whole time I was reading your novel, I was like, this makes me uncomfortable. What are your thoughts on books that discomfort people?
They're important. I mean, I feel like books that make people uncomfortable are the most important books, because if you're always comfortable, nothing about the way you think will ever change. To Kill a Mockingbird, I love To Kill a Mockingbird. It is an interesting book in the way that it examines racism And I think that there are books that should be taught kind of with it, so you have both sides.
Context,
yeah, exactly. But yeah, this book is written to make people uncomfortable. Like, if you're not uncomfortable reading it...
Mission accomplished, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, if you're not uncomfortable reading it, then I did something wrong.
Right, and as we go into Halloween, and we're about to see a whole bunch of costumes that are very inappropriate, we can talk about the Halloween incident in the book in which he and a bunch of friends, mostly white, decide to make a protest, I guess, by dressing as stereotypes. And one of the stereotypes is a KKK. He dresses in a full KKK costume. And I kept thinking, wow, this is advanced. This is advanced for young readers. How did you feel about what material, what questions to answer for your readers and what questions to leave unanswered?
I honestly feel like most questions are left unanswered. And if you think about what is on television and what kids have access to just with iPads, like you go to YouTube, you can see just about anything. So I feel like it's not necessarily, I don't think it's too advanced. The idea for this Halloween statement, I'll put it like that, comes from a character in the novel who believes in this like idea of a post-racial society. So
white kid,
yeah,
very
he's a white, very entitled, and his idea is to set out, like, he wants to set out to prove that things are equal. So we're all going to go out together in these costumes where we're dressed as stereotypes, so that people will see that people who are different can all be together. And the whole thing kind of blows up in his face, as
pretty
one
much
would expect.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, and you know, and I think that it's an important scene, because there's this notion of colorblindness and this idea of like a post-racial society, when at the same time you have police violence, you have people of African American descent being, you know, stopped and frisked and shot, and you know, there are people of color still suffering. So clearly we have a problem, you know?
So let's go back to that and actually hear from a real life instance of this. Jordan Davis was a black teenager. He was shot and killed by a white man because his music was too loud at a gas station. That was over, it was in 2012. We actually spoke with Jordan Davis's mother last year. So here is a comment from Lisey McBath.
I think this is an awakening in the country that is going to cause us as a nation to look at just who we are and what we think about our fellow man, and how much value do you place on the lives of people that don't look, think, or act like you.
In your novel, it doesn't appear that it's written for any particular color of reader. I mean, an African-American teenager is going to identify with the characters as much as a white teenager or any color at all. But were you writing for a specific audience?
I'm writing for everyone. The way I structured the book, the hope was that everybody could find where they, like, their perspective.
Yeah, where they fit.
Yeah, yeah. Like, so there are parts of the book that are pure dialogue. There's no commentary. There are no dialogue tags. It's a name, a colon, and what the person says. And they take place, most of them take place in a classroom. So you're seeing all of these different perspectives, and you're hearing what these different teens are thinking about. And my hope is that in presenting things that way, readers are able to kind of figure out which teen they align with, and then they can kind of think about like where their thoughts line up with what everybody else is saying. So I really wrote it for my sons. I have a 5-year-old and a 1-year-old, and eventually, you know, 10 years from now, it's been 50 years since Dr. King was killed, and look where we are. In 10 years, there are still going to be people. Yeah, there are people who are going to look at my sons, and they're going to see a threat instead of a kid. And so I wanted them to be able to navigate this world that we live in. But the hope is that anybody who reads it can find something in there that they identify with.
That's Atlanta-based author Nick Stone. Her latest book, Dear Martin, is out now. So now let's add a couple more tunes to our Georgia playlist. For this, we ask people to choose two songs that they think best represent Georgia. Two simple rules: nominations have to be songs written or performed by a Georgian, and artists cannot nominate one of their own tunes. Today we feature the Athens band Dream Culture. Frontman Evan Lema makes his picks for the Georgia playlist.
Hey, my name's Evan Lema, and I play in the Athens-based psych rock band Dream Culture. My first pick for the Georgia playlist is Phone Call by Washed Out off of his High Times EP from 2009, which was only originally released on cassette. I chose this one because I ended up listening to this record very obsessively, becoming very obsessed with the way that it sounds, like the sonic signature of it. And I'm assuming also that comes from the fact that, or the possible fact that, the MP3s I was listening to were ripped straight from the cassette tape. And that kind of like helped me segue into this desire for more lo-fi music and for the music that I make to be more lo-fi. It's very sample heavy, which, you know, I'd say the majority of his catalog is, aside from maybe his record Paracosm, very sample heavy, you know, a little bit repetitive. The drums, the whole thing is very dark sounding, you know, a lot of the highs rolled off of it. And, you know, it just kind of has that classic Washed Out vocal to where it sounds like it's coming from a very, very great distance away, very reverb heavy, you know. His moniker being Washed Out is pretty spot on. And then it also stems from a cool personal experience where I was lucky enough to meet Washed Out a couple of times. You know, I got to ask him a question, and I was like, hey, on the song Phone Call, there's this weird phone call, like a literal phone call, at the end of the song. And what is that all about? Like, what's going on there?
Think about the same thing. You're gonna wake in a new realization.
Him and his wife, their eyes widen, and they're like, oh, wow, that's from a long time ago. And they seemed pretty excited to answer the question, and it was that he had just had this weird friend in college who would call him drunk, like, almost every night, and just tell him, like, oh, man, like, you gotta feel it, you know, like, realize the design is divine or whatever. And he just thought it was so funny that he'd throw it in a song. My second pick for the Georgia playlist is Omission by Warehouse, which was a art punk band from Atlanta. They're from Atlanta, art punk band, and I picked it because I remember when I was younger and I got invited to this house show down in Atlanta, and I was really only 17. I remember I walk into the room where all the show is happening and the walls are covered in aluminum foil as sound insulation, and it was very hot in there. And there was Ben's band, and they were playing at like a million miles an hour. So fast, just like da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, very fast. Thank you. I remember Ben was super cool, and he sent me their record like way before it came out. I just ended up listening to this one song, omitting quite a bit. Sonically, Warehouse has always been a little thin, but that's not necessarily to their detriment. You know, that's definitely part of their aesthetic. The drums are a little thin. The guitars are usually pretty clean, maybe sometimes with a little bit of chorus on them. Kind of like a very captured tracksy, you know, kind of like New York art punk sound. Something to definitely touch on would be Elaine Enfield's voice in the track, and her voice in general. Very raspy, very kind of like Janis Joplin-y, and you can sense this kind of like anxiety in their playing and the franticness of it that really puts this image in your head of like, you know, a situation that's like very stressful. And that's kind of what that song conveys, and I think in that sense it's a little bit cathartic, you know, like you could put on Omission or Mental Faculty by Warehouse when you're like really stressed out or something. You know how people say like people who listen to metal music, it makes them like less violent sometimes just because of how cathartic it is. Well, I think possibly, especially off that album Tesseract, some of their stuff is really good to put on if you're ever like a little stressed out.
That's Evan Lema of the Athens-based group Dream Culture. They'll perform at the Caledonia Lounge in Athens this Saturday at 10 p.m. And that's our show for today, but we want your thoughts on Confederate monuments. We'll devote a full hour to Georgia's Confederate statues this month. Should we keep them? Should we destroy them? Should we move them? Why? Why not? Call us at 404-500-9457. Also, you can post on Facebook or reach us on Twitter. The show is at OST Talk. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.